Hello, this is Poland Podcast. I am in LA and sitting beside this young entrepreneur, Henry Elkers, and really delighted to get him on this podcast after I last had dinner with him. And I called the hostess. I said, I must get him onto this podcast. Henry, please just tell us about your journey and about Helena.
It's always great to speak with you, and I always enjoy hanging out with you, so thank you for doing this with me. I'm Henry Elkers. I'm the founder and CEO of Helena. The organization's goal is to be a problem-solving institution, which is a very grand and
how old general. Are you, Henry?
I'm 29.
29. And when did you start Helena?
I started it sophomore year of college. I was at Yale and came out of the dorm room at Yale.
Continue, please.
So 9 years in, we have a portfolio of individual projects where the goal is very simple. Identify solutions to very important societal problems. Do due diligence, which is always very hard to figure out whether the project has a chance at success, whether it should be implemented on a moral and ethical level. And then the step three is actually implement it, which is the hard part. And we now have built a portfolio of these projects in three areas. The first is business. So we're investors and we're building businesses. The second is through nonprofit projects. Mm. Because sometimes the best way to implement a solution is not to make money. And in fact, making money from it is actually going to corrupt the incentive structure. And then the third is actually legislation, both nationally and internationally. And we're generalists. So our projects have spanned from investing in nuclear fusion to address the energy crisis.
Nuclear fusion.
Which we can get into, all the way to alternatives for plastics, styrofoam, all the way to nonprofit projects to protect the electrical grid from the many threats that it faces, to depolarization projects. And so, but the main thing that we're trying to do over time is I want to run this the rest of my life and hand it off. I want to build something that's a very long-term institution. And to go into why we're doing this.
At the age of 20 years old, you started Helena. At the age of 20 years old, you should be partying and going to nightclubs. I mean, this is incredible.
Well, I think there's a reason why people, when they're very young, take on very ambitious things, which is delusion. And I think if I had known the challenges that we would face and how hard this was, it would have been very different of a decision. But when you're that age, I think there's a huge amount of benefit to your outlook on the world.
Of course.
And what you think is possible. It's actually it's a much more simple world because you don't know what you're going to face.
I wouldn't use the word delusion, but fearless, because you don't know the obstacles. So you became fearless.
Somebody very famous said this quote, but the to pretend that you have courage is actually just to have courage, right? As long as you're actually doing it. So I think we, because we have an amazing team now, made every mistake under the book. We embarrassed ourselves. We've done a lot of different things, but it was such an amazing education to go through over the last now decade. And I think the next decade for us is going to be amazing as well.
Can you simply tell how you start Helena and then you drop out from Yale?
Yes.
Just to focus in doing Helena. So, but at 20 years old, drop out, what did your parents say? I mean, are you crazy? Dropping out from university and doing something. Helena is an NGO. You're not making a living.
So, well, no, we are, but we now have a for-profit.
Of course, of course.
At the time, though, we actually did start it as a nonprofit.
At the time, on the 20 years old, they would think, what are you doing? How do you persuade your parents?
Well, I'll answer why.
Yeah,
why we started first. I think it was a combination of very selfish and practical things with a more grandiose set of ideals. I was, sophomore year at Yale, it's a very competitive environment, and your friends start looking at internships. That's the first thing they think is, you work so hard to get into this amazing university, what am I going to do next? And I think, observe my friends and their, shall we say, mental model of what they wanted to do with their life. And what scared me was how quickly it jumped from, well, I'm at Yale, I need to go to Goldman, or I need to go do this, and there's very real reasons for that. which I deeply respect, but it scared me a lot because I said, I don't want to make a blind decision to jump into a career. So that got me to start really thinking in a very kind of low pressure way. If I had all the resources in the world, if I could do whatever I want, what would I actually want to do? And this is also at the time where you have your kind of like 1/5 life crisis when you're 20 and you kind of start thinking these existential thoughts. And what was really concerning to me was, you know, again, I'd be very open, kind of the male ego of I want to do something important in the world.
While, you change the world.
While I was reading history at Yale. And when you study history in very long time spans, it's very clear that there's a very small number of things that actually matter every 100 years. Like when the 21st century will be written by historians in the 23rd century, we're not going to be talking about all these small, you know, kind of technologies or things. We're going to be talking about AI. We're going to be talking about biology.
Biotech.
And there's a very small number. So I wanted to be involved in those things. And that got me to say, okay, how can I be involved in those things? And there's a set of organizations that we rely on as a society to solve major, major issues. So I started to study those organizations. And there was something that was really, really powerful to me about what I kind of learned just from, again, a very kind of delusional and very kind of first principles, low information environment, which is we are undergoing an extraordinarily radical shift in the world right now, in which, starting with the Manhattan Project, when we created the nuclear weapon, we are creating exponential technologies, some of which have the capacity to destroy the world.
Wow.
Starting with nuclear weapons. But now we're doing like 20 of these Manhattan Projects at once. We're doing it in biology and in energy. So this is happening. So then the organizations that we've set up and relied upon, these institutions to solve these problems, that should actually be helping further these further humanity's response to these technologies.
Humanity,
and these movies,
yeah.
They were often built hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And so the structure of these organizations, even though they were extraordinarily well-intentioned, most of them, are actually quite archaic and they're decaying. And so I'm sitting there at a young age and going, okay, there's actually an extraordinary opportunity, but one that has very high stakes, which is instead of just working on one technology or one thing, what if I could actually build a institution that did something at a more broad level? What if I could build something that was actually native to the way the 21st century worked, that actually tries to improve upon or actually just start something afresh? So the question I asked myself is, if there was going to be a successful problem-solving organization that was actually native to the 21st century and what modalities we're going to see and what movements we're going to see, what would that look like? So I started studying the structures of all these organizations over the last couple hundred years. Some of them were NGOs, some of them were think tanks, some of them were capitalist institutions, so large funds, sovereign wealth funds, and try to think about what was right about them, what was wrong, what were their incentives. And so from that, I kind of challenged myself and said—
You did a case study of—
Yeah, and again, I had the benefit of standing on the shoulders of hundreds and hundreds of years, if not more, of people that have tried to solve this problem. And it's not really their fault, obviously, because a lot of these institutions, how could you possibly know 500 years before that something like AI would occur, right? So that was what ended up becoming Helena, which ended up being a very simple structure, which is just build an organization that can do the following things. Step one, be really world-class, if possible, at attracting the best ideas that could solve important problems of any type, businesses, nonprofits. Step two, somehow be able to do the due diligence. Somehow be able to ascertain whether these ideas should be implemented or not. And for that, you need a lot of expertise. And then step three, have the operational capability of actually manifesting these projects, whether it's putting capital towards them, whether it's actually running them. So I wanted to build that whole thing. And the more and more I've kind of built this organization, the more I've realized that this is a more than a lifetime of work. We're at the very, very beginning of this. And it's very humbling because we've barely scratched the surface of impact. I think what we've done is great so far, but we have so much more to do.
But when you started, you need capital and you drop out from Yale. And what do your parents say? Then how do you raise money? And how do you get your get people to trust you, to believe in you, to work together with you?
So it was the mother of chicken and egg problems, because if you think about the organizations that do what Helena does, they usually start with a huge endowment, or they're a family foundation, or they're a family office where they start with a large amount of money and then they allocate that capital. But when you start without that, you have to build that up. And so what we did was...
When you say we, who is... Well,
Myself and then my team that we've now built, and my Sam Feinberg, who dropped out of school with me, and he's been instrumental.
So the both of you drop out, and the both of you were working together to build the team.
Yes. And so the problem that we had to solve was, how do we get the resources to do this work?
Yes, right? Exactly.
So this is what we did. We had this idea of, let's create a membership. Let's create a membership of people first. And somehow, let's try to, this is crazy, but let's try to convince some of the top leaders across disciplines, in industry, but also in the arts, the sciences, to join our organization. And the idea there was very simple, which is, people represent those resources.
Yeah.
People represent capital. They represent political will. Yeah. They represent political capital. They represent expertise. They represent all the things that we would need to have. And so instead of trying to raise the capital, I actually said, what if we first get the people and then put them in some sort of system in which they want to be there? And so the idea was actually to do the complete inverse of a Davos or a TED, in which we don't charge them anything, but we somehow try to convince these people to join. So in the dorm room, what I did is I wrote out and researched thousands of these people and just emailed them cold. And my thinking was, I have the yale.edu email address from a student, so maybe they'll see the Yale address and then want to join. And I wrote these hilarious emails that I cringe when I look at them, basically saying, I'm a student at Yale, and I have this vision to create an organization that does this, and I really am trying to build this network first. And then I'm going to work with the members once they come in to then work on the projects and do the projects. And obviously, when you're pitched that, there's an advantage from pitching it from a young person, which is that it's
people want to support you.
Yeah, they want to support you. But I think the reality is it is an incredibly infeasible idea when there's no track record. So we got absolutely nearly no responses. But you only need one person to join.
Yeah, one.
And the first person that joined was Myron Scholes, who I'm eternally grateful for. Myron won the Nobel Prize in Economics. And we were able to then leverage.
He just respond to your letter.
It took a while. We had to communicate with him a lot and tell him about the vision and all of that. And it wasn't easy. But once we had that, we were able to then get two or three
because
members.
You have one.
Yeah. And so what we were very skilled at was making bets on younger leaders who represented technologies that older leaders or people of more advanced age who already ran in very important institutions wanted to hear about. So some of the younger Helena members were innovating in AI, in cryptocurrency, and all these areas that at the time and still are very, very important, very new technologies that people didn't understand that well. And so there was a huge desire from the members that are the four-star generals in the military or the running large institutions to actually use Helena as a way to communicate with them. So for the first year, we raised no money. We didn't do any projects. We actually just ran this group, but we did it in the complete inverse of a networking group. There was no monetization of it. We never asked anybody for money. And we just said, let's run this where you tell me exactly what you want to do during the next couple years of your life. And then when you go to sleep at night every night and you worry you're not going to achieve that, why? And when you ask that question to a billionaire or somebody running a large institution, it's usually not, I need more money. It's usually, hey, there's this specific discipline that I don't have access to, or there's a specific idea I want to learn more about. And so I would find the other person in our network that we could bring, and I would set them up.
Oh.
And we would, and still do this, we wouldn't just make an introduction. We would host the meeting, take all the notes, and then do the follow-up. So we wanted to become indispensable to this group. And so after a year of building this group of people up, we were then able to use these meetings to generate the ideas that later became the projects. And that's how we started the organization into the operational side. Then we did 5 years of these nonprofit projects. Then we started the parallel for-profit and started investing.
When you say parallel for-profit, how?
Well, we started Helena, and it was just the members. And that was the first chapter.
Yeah.
Then we started to do a couple of these nonprofit projects that I can tell you about in carbon capture, so taking carbon dioxide out of the air, sequestering it, storing it underground, and building an industry there, protecting the electrical grid, which was an legislative project we did, and then American One Room, which we can talk about. So we built a portfolio of these nonprofit projects, and we raised tens of millions of dollars. This was over a five-year period. Once we built that track record, we then said, our vision has always been to have not just legislative and nonprofit, but we do need to interact with the business community. And so then we launched with some seed capital that we raised the for-profit investment side of Helena, which does the same thing. It just invests in projects and builds companies that are addressing critical societal issues.
I just read about your American in One Room, talking about deliberative democracy, which is really interesting because today we are talking about American election.
Yeah.
And you are trying to address and get to know what Americans want.
Yeah.
So can you briefly tell us about this? Because how do you get the sampling of 500 and you spend 4 days? I thought, wow, at your age, at 20-something, you can do things like it's wild.
Well, it wasn't just me. It took an incredible group of people to do.
And you were working with the Stanford University, right?
Yeah, so I'll tell you the story.
Yeah,
so,
please do.
I was one of the Helena members, is named Nicholas Bergruen.
Oh, yeah. I know Nick, yes.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy. And I'm very grateful for him and his introductions and the work that we've done with him. And through him, I went to one of his amazing philosophy galas where he gives away $1 million a year, kind of like the Nobel Prize for philosophy. Yeah. And I sat next to somebody who later became a Helena member named Jim Fishkin, who is one of the two leaders of the Stanford Center for Deliberative Democracy.
Yeah.
And he sat next to me during this dinner and then kind of in this amazing mad scientist kind of way unfurled to me what deliberative democracy is. And it's this incredible idea, which is a scientific way of selecting a group of people that is representative of a country. So could you get 500 plus people where that group of 500 on demographics, et cetera, are actually as representative as possible of the entire nation? And it turns out that there's actually a long history of being able to do this in which you can actually put together a sample. And this has been done in 30 different countries over 100 different times by Stanford. And so there's this amazing track record of this. At the same time, we're now dealing with some of the worst polarization in our country,
absolutely.
Which is a huge limiting factor to doing anything. If you can't communicate, you can't make decisions, then you're not going to be able to solve these problems. So I'll just tell you a couple interesting things. There was a study that I find really interesting where they asked 1 million Americans what they thought of the Civic Affairs Act. And everybody had a very powerful opinion on this. They said, I either like it or I don't like it. So they did this poll and they asked them what they thought, but the Civic Affairs Act doesn't exist.
Okay.
So it's an example of how polling, which is understanding what the will of the people is, which is what the founding fathers of America and kind of the underpinning of democracy is, understanding what the people want and then making decisions based upon that.
Yeah.
But the normal way that we do polling has so many flaws. So there's a huge need to actually have a better system of understanding what the will of the people is that is especially accentuated in today's kind of media age in which everything is manipulated. So that was a very clear need. And then when we heard about what Stanford was doing with the Deliberative Democracy Center and what the track record was, that generated this really profound and kind of crazy idea, which is, what if we could put all of America representatively in one room? What if we could actually select a sample of people that represented the entire country of voters? And so we actually did it. We raised the money and we did a project. We had these amazing partners. We did it with Helena and Stanford, Jim Fishkin and Larry Diamond and others. This was in 2019. And there was two groups. There was the group of 500 plus people. I think it was about 535 people. And then there was a control group of also 500 people that didn't go to the event.
Okay, control group.
So here's what we did. We bought out the largest hotel in Texas. It's this giant hotel called the Gaylord Texan Hotel. And it's just like this mall. It's enormous. And we kicked everybody out. And then we flew in all 535 people. So we actually put America into one room. And they spent 3 straight days with each other. Before they arrived, they did an extensive poll about what their incoming views were on the 5 most important issues facing the country for the election. So what are your views on immigration in these areas? What are your views on foreign policy? So we got their starting value. Then what they did for the next 3 days is they spent 8 hours in small groups talking over and over and over again, debating these issues. And they had fact checkers, they had a full briefing document with the best arguments from both sides. I can get into the architecture of how that works. And at the end of those 8 hours, we had everybody converge to one room. We had America in one room, and the photos are just wonderful. It was the most diverse room, I think, statistically in American history, if you think about it.
Yes, of course. This
ballroom in Texas where, and then they would actually ask questions to the presidential candidates or to experts that represented those views. So they did this for 3 straight days, and it was obviously on a data level, this magical thing, but it was also this huge moment in which during this incredibly polarized time, Nobody fought. No, you know, people were extremely, they were passionate, but they cared about each other. So then we gave them the same poll. Remember, there was a poll at the beginning. We gave them the same poll at the end of the 3 days, and their views radically changed over those 3 days. And this is not us saying this. We had the New York Times, you know, we had an incredible amount of press coverage that we gave Open Kimono all of the data to say, this is our methodology, this is how we're doing it. And the results were endorsed by both the right and the left. And what we saw was up to 50% changes in people's political views over these 3 days. And the stories are absolutely incredible. For example, I met a woman who was in a abusive marriage, and she just wasn't allowed to talk about politics. Her husband would beat her. And she had this opportunity to come to this event without her husband there. And she, for the first time, she was able to even discuss these issues. And she was able to actually realize what she believed. There's also somebody very, like, this is the funny story where we had to milk somebody's cow because somebody was in a farm and they was, I'll go to the event, but I'm going to be 3 days away. And so we had to set these things up, which were really interesting. So this was, became a real sensation in the media because it was this, the New York Times did portraits of all 500 plus people and they put it on the cover and Obama tweeted it out. And so it was two things. The first is it was this data that showed that Americans actually agree so much more than the media says they do. There was no cell phones, there was no social media. It was just human to human, like we're talking now. But then the second thing was just the spectacle of democracy actually working. And of course, it was in a vacuum. It was in a very controlled environment. But here's one thing that's interesting: the New York Times surprised us about a year later, and without our permission, which is totally their right, they went and they polled the same group of people, but in their hometowns, because a year had passed. And the thinking is obvious, which is, you go through this amazing three-day period, you have these major changes, but then you come back to your hometown.
And you will flip back.
You flip back, but they didn't. That's the interesting thing, is in the follow-up study, we showed a remarkable amount of stickiness in their opinions. And what happened was these people became celebrities in their hometown. They wrote op-eds, they went on local television, and I'm still in contact with a lot of them now, even 5 years later. So the magic of this is actually that it's not just a transformational experience for these folks in that room, but they bring it back to their hometowns and it spreads. And so Stanford, for example, has now done this in high schools across the country. And we've now done multiple of these American One Rooms. The one that we just did finished about a month or two ago, and it was just on first-time voters. So we've built this kind of this kind of project that we've now done many different times, all about bringing together a scientifically representative sample of the country and then to understand what the will of the people is, and then to get that to politicians and get that to elected officials and institutions so they can make decisions based upon it.
But you are saying that the will of the people, even when they return back home, it hasn't changed.
To be as accurate as possible, there, of course, are some changes.
In general.
In general, there is a remarkable correlation to the data being very sticky, to people actually keeping their opinions. But not just keeping them privately, espousing them to their families and their communities.
Yes, of course, you influence, you start discussing about it and all that. So who was the one who did all the, did you prepare all the questions, the topics and all that? And how did that come up?
So it was very important. First of all, we are not experts in political science to what Stanford is. Yeah. So there's on that front. But number two, it's very important that we were able to show that Helena was not involved in anything that could manipulate the data, because we're an organization that has many different projects. So our role was to put the project together, the branding, raise the capital, and orchestrate the effort. But Stanford has been an exceptional partner in doing all of the political
science. The content.
And there's really important things. So you have to put together an advisory group that represents all political views on an issue. So if we're talking about environment, we need somebody from a right-leaning think tank, and then the left one. That has to be put together. And then there's what they produce are these amazing briefing documents, these 55-page kind of papers that state all. What was interesting is a lot of people told us, you're going to put everyday Americans in one room, and you're going to expect them to read this 55-page document, which is actually incredibly insulting to think about that. But what happened was everybody read it, and everybody read it. These are people who they all sat down and they saw this event as a sacred and very important thing.
Yes.
And they read these documents end to end and incorporated into their ideas. And so the entire project was such an emotional experience for me, because in your heart, there's this philosophical debate: are humans inherently good or evil? Rousseau versus Hobbes, right?
Black or white, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And My belief is humans are inherently good, but they can be manipulated by outside stimuli, social media, all this stuff. Because when you have a $1 trillion corporation that is using an algorithm to micro-schedule in your brain, I'm going to show you this content, it can manipulate people.
Yeah.
And this is what we've seen throughout history. But my assumption was you can actually create an environment in which humans can talk to humans and they will actually respect and love each other and they will want to solve problems. And I think that was proven over and over and over again by this project. So now our question is, can we scale it up so that millions of people can go through this experience rather than just thousands?
And could this influence your polling system as well?
So it's a great question. I think if I had all the money in the world and I could do whatever I would like with the American One Room project, I would do one of these every month. So there would be and think about it, it would be like an advisory council for the American people.
There would be
a citizen group that is representative of the country that is consistently meeting. And my hope is that would actually influence and hopefully, to its logical extent, replace polling. Because would you rather have a poll that just calls somebody up at 3 a.m. in the morning?
Yes.
But the issue is polls are accurate because they do get what people think. But if you ask somebody what they think about NAFTA and they haven't spent 3 days talking to the world's experts about NAFTA, they're going to have a different view once they do that.
Of course. So this is their view becomes a result of all the communication and all what they are.
And this goes back to why Helena should exist and why there needs to be another type of institution to address large societal problems. We're now in a world in which the complexity of the development of technology, the complexity of what's happening is so large that we need to provide as a service to the American people as much information in as pure of a way as possible for them to make the most important decisions of their lives when they vote.
Absolutely. Because you did mention about technology and also media that affects the world, especially, the last 100 years, there's a big change. But now we have technology and media. So how do you see with all that affecting the world?
Well, you need media. I think it's a double-edged sword because it's essential that there be a rigorous media that can educate the public, that can use sunshine as a disinfectant, as they say. There's an amazing quote from a founding father that if there was a choice between the perfect democracy and a perfect media, you would choose the perfect media because it always creates the perfect democracy.
Mm.
So you need to have an information system that provides.
But today, do you consider that is a great?
Of course not.
I mean,
of course not. And I think one of the big things that Helena and a lot of its members, like Tristan Harris and Asa Raskin, work on is how can social media companies, which I do think are led by people that have good hearts.
Well-intentioned
people, but they've built something of such power that can influence people's thinking in these subconscious ways. And we've just never dealt with that as a species before. Our brains are not designed to stand up to, and you see this with the suicidality rate, the mental health stuff with young people using social media. Because if you're shown, for example, my mom was a ballerina, she was a dancer, and I was having a conversation with her about this. When she was 13, 14 years old, there was no social media.
Yeah.
She was able to just focus on her craft and she was never comparing. But now if you're a 13-year-old ballerina, you go on TikTok or Instagram and you see the best 13-year-old ballerina in the world, somebody who you will potentially never become as good at. That's extraordinarily demoralizing. And think about that manifested in every possible category. Our brains are not really meant to be subjected to that type of force. So it's a very, so when you define media, then you say, okay, well, is that media? Or, is like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times media? And the answer is both. Media is the data that we are intaking into our brains.
But the problem today is your generation, your Gen Z generation, you don't even like to read long news. If there's coverage which is written very, very long, you just ignore it. Even in a social media, if there's an interview, no. And so how do you think that, why wouldn't they just buy in social media news? Because it's short and it's to your face and there's no due diligence. I've never seen any Gen Z would go and try and find out this is right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So
why are people still addicted to opium?
Yeah.
No, seriously, if you feed an addictive drug to a population, they're going to be addicted to it. It's very simple. And so we're feeding junk food. And you can see this, actually, the human attention span itself has decreased over the last 50
to 100 years. You know, the younger generation doesn't have the attention span.
So I'll tell you, the most meaningful thing I've done in my life is get extraordinarily into reading and reading books. I read constantly. And when I started to read books, this is embarrassing to say, but I never really read in college. I always kind of BS'd it. I would do just enough reading to go to the class, right? I never really sat down and had the joy of reading a great work, you know, a Tolstoy front to back or something of that nature. And when I started Helena, I had a really formidable conversation with a friend of mine where he was kind of, you know, as friends do, being very direct with me, saying, look, you're smart, but you're not smart enough to deal with these people that you have in your membership. It's amazing you've got these people, but these are the experts in the world. Yes. Subjects. You're not smart enough to just hang with them. You need to really, in a humble way, read at a very deep level about as much as you possibly can and make that a lifelong journey. And I started to do that. But to your point, when I started to read for the first time, just like anybody else my age, I was infected by social media too. And I still am. I still battle with it just like everybody else. It was extraordinarily challenging just to get through one page. But once you force yourself, your brain is a muscle and it becomes elastic. And you can then read longer and longer periods. And once you actually get into this understanding that you can actually read about the best ideas that humans have ever come up with for thousands and thousands of years, you can put that in your brain for free, essentially for free. It's the most beautiful and wonderful thing. And that's being deprived to a lot of people when their diet is really being weaponized in short form content. And I could speak about this. I'm very passionate about the subject.
Yeah, but how can you, in your organization, how can you create this initiative and how could you encourage your generation to be more focused on books? To read, to have better attention span, to read through long essays, articles, and also to have a mind that would do due diligence in everything that they read.
It's
really pretty impossible.
It's not impossible. I think you do have to acknowledge the challenge of that problem because you're fighting against forces that are. They're growing in power every day.
Yes, exactly.
But I do think it's doable. And if I were to guess, because I've thought about this for a very long time, I'm sure you've thought about it for longer than I have, I think it has to do with using technology to best understand learning styles and then feed people great information in that style. So for me, for example, my ego is, so, you know, is if somebody tells me you have to read this when I was 18, 19 years old, I would, no, fuck you, I don't want to read it, right?
I can understand.
But when you go... oh, I'm really curious about that thing. And you pick up the book and then you kind of, without any pressure, start reading it. You go, wait, this is very valuable. I want to keep doing this. And that was the magic that I got when I started to read. And that was very infectious. So that's my learning style. There are other people that need to be told that you need to read this, then you need to read this, then you need to read this. And that actually jumpstarts them. So what I think this goes to AI, right? This will be perhaps the last technology that humans ever invent. Because every technology after that won't be invented by humans, it'll be invented by AI, is that when we are able to create a way of thinking artificially that can understand how the brain learns better than we currently understand it, I think then, but it's an incredible threat because AI-based selection for media is one of the ways, it's the most powerful tool. So, you can point it one direction, it's very negative, point it another direction, it's very positive.
So since we are talking about AI, the ethics of AI, I mean, have you been researching? And, you know, if you are using AI in a positive way, right. But what is the limitation? Did anybody think a bit beyond that?
Oh, of course. I mean, this is the most important question in the world, perhaps ever. I think when we look back, when historians look back, they may just at that point be AI historians, but when they look back at this era, I think... humans have used tools throughout the history of our species, but we've never built a tool that is smarter than us.
Smarter than us, exactly.
Right, and so part of this answer is actually definitionally not really possible to answer. Here's why. There's a great philosopher named Saint Anselm, and his definition of God was that which nothing more can be conceived. What that means is, think about what your brain is capable of understanding, and then whatever is beyond that is God. Now think about what the definition of artificial general intelligence is, right? A thinking agent that is more capable at doing stuff and thinking than any human can be at anything, right? Once it surpasses that. So what I mean by this is, by definition, we don't necessarily know what an AI will do once it passes that point, because it is beyond our human cognition to think about it. So we're actually going to be relying on the AI in a deferred judgment way, in a way that's eerily similar to how we did with the gods. When in Greek society, you would have, well, I believe in Zeus, or I believe in X, Y, and Z god. We're going to have the same thing. We're going to have AIs that I think are temperamental because we've designed them to be that way. They're going to have this type of personality. So this is a bit of a diatribe, but this goes into how challenging the problem is. So when we go into AI ethics, we also confront another issue, which is humans have not agreed on what ethics are for the last 4,000 or 5,000 years.
Absolutely.
So how can we program ethics into an AI when we have not yet understood that? And the attempts that have been made to do so, you really run into these quite challenging issues. And then you consult the fact that different cultures have vehement disagreements
completely different of
what ethics are. And so this is an exceptionally hard problem. And not to be dark, but I was listening to this amazing podcast that Peter Thiel just did.
And he
was asked about intelligent extraterrestrial species, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this concept called the great filter, which is this idea that civilizations end up destroying themselves after a certain point of development because they create nuclear weapons, or they use them, or they create an even God-fearing
self-destruction.
Exactly. Yeah. So then the question is, what civilizations make it through that phase? And his answer was really depressing to me, but to be honest, it's hard to think of a better answer, which is, he says, they're either angels or they're demons. The demon is the one that has just the kind of super Hitler, right? This authoritarian kind of force that is able to just take power. And so that person's able to not guide civilization through it, but then you've enslaved the, so you don't want that. And then there's this idea of being angels, in which somehow we're enlightened to the point where even though we could exert such harm with these exponential technologies, we don't. But then you have to think about what type of world would we need to have in which everybody, there's not a single instance of use of this terrible kind of set of technology. That's very hard to imagine as well. And so that's a very fancy way of saying the AI ethics problem is exceptionally hard.
Exceptionally hard.
And so some people believe that the only way to solve the AI ethics problem is just to develop this AI, which is inevitable, and then ask it what ethics are. And this is a really fascinating thing I've been thinking about quite a lot and talking with a lot of the members on.
Because you can't control the AI when you build something so much more stronger than you. There's no control.
Yes.
At the end is, they will control the world. Because you have to depend on them.
Yes, but we depend on God. And I'm not saying this in a religious context, we define God as that which nothing more can be conceived. We
say Father Almighty.
We say it's omniscient and omnipotent. It's all-powerful and it's all-knowing. But if we develop an AI that to us is all-powerful and all-knowing, what is the difference? And so we already have this precedent in civilization of deciding or saying or believing there's this God, and we need to follow the judgment of that God. And my kind of pessimistic or maybe just realistic view is that while we look at AI and go now, and maybe we say, okay, well, we're not going to believe it if it says this or this, when that actually happens, when there is a development of AI that has that level of power and capacity that is so beyond what we see, when it says, hey, this is the way we solve climate change, build this thing, or it says, hey, you need to vote for this, that's going to be an incredibly powerful statement.
Remember, God, we worship God.
Yes.
Do you think that with the human ego, we are going to worship an AI that is created by human?
Yes, because the AI will understand how to manipulate.
Yeah, and then it will become all those movies, those sci-fi movies that I've been watching when I was young about human fighting against AI.
It may, but it will likely be something that none of the movies have been able to dream up because they were dreamed up by humans. And this goes back to the definitional problem. So, no, this is something that I think we are struggling with. But let me bring it back to the practical, which is, We can debate this ethically, but it's just going to happen.
You can't stop it. We just have to live with it and see.
I think we have to really actively use this time to give to come up with the best possible tools for humanity to regulate, understand, and develop it. And one of the saddest things that's happening, we want to do the next American One Room on AI policy. I hope we can pull it off. But we want to get a representative sample of the American people and actually educate them as best as possible, which will be very challenging because it's hard to even educate me or anybody on this, on the most important ethical policy issues on AI. And then actually get a judgment on what the will of the people is on that. That's an example. That's not going to solve AI ethics, but it is at least an attempt at addressing it at a higher level of fidelity.
And also to make people aware.
Yes. And so
awareness is important.
And by the way, I have some level of sympathy with the large AI companies, the open AIs of the world, because what they're saying is we want to be regulated. We do actually want to have judgment on what decisions to make. But if you look at the state of even the EU, which has done the best job of even thinking about this, they're so far behind. And then you look at the Americans and you look at how slow Congress has been on AI regulation. It is just a fact that the gap between the public sector's ability to regulate the technology versus the rate of development of the technology is already this wide, and it's already going to widen in the future.
I don't think the public actually really understand AI in the way that it will be going to be developed. So with your American in one room, if you can do AI policy as a discussion point, it would be amazing.
Yeah, I think it would. I mean, there are these really, really important questions that are, some of them are very philosophical because the questions are something that will manifest in the future, but some of them are extraordinarily practical. Like truck driving is one of the largest jobs in America. What happens when we just have autonomous trucks? So it's very important to have the head of the trucking union really have a good faith, non-gotcha discussion with the American people, but also with the developers of this technology on how to do it. The population of horses is much, much smaller now than it was when we were riding horses as the main mode of transportation.
Yes.
So it's not like we've never gone through shifts that are similar to this, but we've never gone through a shift that is this pronounced. And this will be the most important invention that humans ever make, because it will create all other future inventions after that.
Okay, talking about you are an entrepreneur, right? So I just read that 14 years old, you already have a clothing company. A street fashion clothing.
A very bad one.
It was 14 years old. And then how do you raise, what inspired you with that? What sparks you to have this fashion company? And how do you raise your capital? And how do you sell?
I think to call that a legitimate business would be
14 years old. Yeah.
No, I think, I've always been fascinated with the creation of things, and I've always wanted to do it. And I think you start in a very kind of misguided and small way, and then you iterate and you iterate. But I'm very grateful that I had, I think the one thing I will say is just I'm more willing to be embarrassed than other people. I think that's a skill that you need is that I'm a very emotional person. I really don't like being wrong. I really don't like when I'm being made fun of, but I'm able to bear that. And I don't know if this is the actual Greek definition or etymology of the word, but somebody told me once that one of the definitions of entrepreneurship is to bear risk, that entrepreneur is a bearer
absolutely.
Of risk.
Absolutely.
And so I think that there's, you have to have some level of willingness to do that. And I think one of the things that I often see, especially with friends of mine, is that I'm just lucky for, because I just did this before I had a job, is they graduate from a top university or they whatever, and they get a great job. And there's obviously the family situation, the financial situation, which this gets into, I have an immense privilege. I'm able to do what I do. But beyond that, there's this security of just saying, if I start this business, what will people think of me? How will I be judged? Will I be made fun of? And this idea that everybody's going to kind of whisper to each other about you. It's funny because it will happen no matter what, but also people will forget. And the realization of how little you matter and how little it matters if people judge you, I think that's a very liberating and freeing thing.
But do you care?
Of course I care. Of course everybody cares. But I also care more about what my work could do if it is successful.
Exactly, exactly.
And you just have to be willing to make those judgments. I'm sure you have it in your career.
Yeah,
you have to
you
be willing to make those judgments. And also, I think I'm still young, but the older I get, the less I care. I think too, the more that I'm very engrossed with what can be done with the work that we're doing.
But for 14 years old, a street fashion, you know what street fashion was when you were 14?
No, it was horrendous. It was, I still have some of the, designs.
Yeah, but it's great. It's great that you are fearless and you have the courage just to step into it. Whether it's, you know, successful or not, you know, this is your dream and you do it. You do it. Do you sell to your friends?
Still. No, I mean, we sold very few of them.
Never mind, but at least you did it.
And also, it's, I mean, just kind of boring to say on a podcast, but you go through, what is an LLC? What is the entity formation I need to do? How do I take in capital? How do I work with a lawyer? How do I do these extraordinarily basic things that, by the way, some people who are in their 30s or 40s or 50s who have just always worked for somebody else and have never started something new,
they
look at
these
and it is an incredible, it's like looking at Mount Everest from the base. It's just, oh, but I don't really know how to do that. And once you just go through those repetitions, I think you're able to be accustomed to what you can do with business. That the allocation of capital, the allocation of time and resources, what can be achieved in the world through that?
Wow, you learn at 14. That's brilliant.
But make your mistakes young. You make your mistakes as young as possible. When they are as less damaging as possible to your life, it is very valuable to do that.
18 years old, you were president of an international cooperative fund. What is it? And then you were sitting on the Wall Street Journal expert panel. Talk to me about it.
There's nothing really to say. I mean, these are all, to be honest, failed very small.
Never mind, because
things,
you have the courage, the balls to do it at your young age, and those are the experience which is really needed to form your.
Well, I think you're getting to a larger point, which is very important. Which is, I do think that I was talking recently to somebody starting a business who was 20 years old, and I caught myself judging that person. I caught myself listening to this and go, oh, this guy doesn't, he has no idea. Look how arrogant this guy is. And he's making these leaps of assumptions of he's going to do this and this and this. And then I caught myself, I was like, well, that was just me. And it still is, by the way. People still look at me and think that way. But people especially did at that age. And I remember getting these emails from people just saying, this is, you know, really just nasty things. And it's kind of like bullying. It's somebody has to stop the cycle at some point. If you're bullied, then you bully somebody else. And so I do think at a cultural level, there's problems in the lionification and the of entrepreneurs and seeing them as gods, which they should not be. But there's also problems in kind of cutting people while they're weak, cutting them down while they're weak and when they're just starting out. And I think there has to be a higher willingness to accept those types of people. There has to be a better environment for them.
Absolutely.
We also need to cultivate people that are just tougher. That are just able to get through it. And if you look at the really great entrepreneurs, I think name an entrepreneur that has really over a long period of time succeeded where it wasn't a fluke, it wasn't just luck, that didn't have grit, that wasn't able to just stay in the game. And you need to have that.
You need to have that personality, that determination, and completely full of convictions.
Yes, yes.
And I think that's what brought you to Helena. After 14, 18, and when you had Helena, you focus and you push through.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, you know, they say when you meet the person you're going to spend the rest of your life with, you just know. It is similar. I mean, these businesses that we start, especially when there are lifelong things, it's like a marriage. It's something at that level of, if not more, special. And with Helena, when I look back at that time, there's a term, I think it's called reverse founder syndrome, which is when you talk to somebody 10 years after they started their business and they go, well, here's exactly what I did this and I did this and I did this. And you just need to do the same thing. And it's complete bullshit, of course, because they've been through so much trauma that they've actually rewired their memories and their brain to make it a simpler and more linear path or to add more drama to it. And in reality, it's just hard.
It is hard.
But when you know that what you're working on, even when it's at its darkest moment and most people are making fun of you and you haven't actually proven yourself, when you're in that moment and you go, wait, I still want to do this. In fact, I'm actually even more motivated. That's when you really know that you have something. Maybe it's still not going to work, by the way, but you have something that you are going to assign your full self to. And it's not about the money. It's not about the power or any of those things. It's just you want it that badly. That's what you need.
But I think when you were starting Helena, you also have your partner.
Yes. So I have an incredible business partner. Yes.
And so I think with two of you believing in each other, egging each other, is really pushing it through.
Yes, we absolutely need each other. We needed each other. There were times where I was at very, very dark moments, and then Sam, my business partner, got me out of it, and then vice versa. You also need somebody with the yin yang qualities of personality.
Yes, of course, of course.
They have to have this. They have to have. So my business partner was the world debate champion.
Oh, wow. He was the world
debate. So he's never debate this guy. I think I'm an okay debater, but I have a different style of communication than him. He was also he's incredible at economics and at math. He's very quantitative. And what's interesting is I've watched actually my skill set and his areas of strength go up just by being around him. And I've watched vice versa, his areas of weakness get better. And those are the great partnerships in which you're confrontational with each other, but you're respectful. When you disagree and then you commit, you don't make fun of each other in public. Even when you've made a mistake, you say that in private. These are all the things you have to cultivate over time.
My
God. I totally agree.
You two raising money must be dynamic.
You know what's so funny is when you don't have anything as a track record to show for it and you're raising money versus when you do, it's a very different thing to do.
When you have to sell.
So I think we now
have that trust.
We now have the privilege of. It's easier now because you
say
we've done this. We've done this over.
Yeah. And then you build trust.
Yeah.
When you have nothing and just on paper and dreams and words.
Yes.
It's very tough.
But I'm obviously everybody has to do it. But I'm very glad that we went through that initial period. You know, of raising nine-figure amounts of money at this point, hundreds of millions of dollars, across the for-profit and the nonprofit. And we still have a lot more to do. I mean, that's for a lot of people. That's a huge amount of money for the people that I look up to. That's nothing.
Especially, it's amazing.
Thank you, but you have to communicate a confidence that, and you have to communicate that to very sophisticated people with incredible bullshit meters, right? They're right, and so the only way to do it is to truly believe. I think that's the personality I have. Is just like I look back at, for example, raising our first for-profit capital for these investments. I said this is the research we did on this investment. I deeply believe this company is going to succeed, and I will argue with you for 10 hours about this. And if you tell me something that I'm wrong about, I'm going to go home, read about it, upskill myself, understand it, and then come back to you. And I think that is probably one of the reasons why. I think the other reason is luck. I think you have to have an exceptional amount of luck.
Yeah, of course. You have a great combination. Now, if a young person coming to you and asks you, can you give us some tips, some suggestion, what I should do? Should I become an entrepreneur? Should I follow my dreams? What would you advise them?
One of the worst mistakes I see people make, and people make it over and over, is they wake up in the morning and say, I want to start a company. Terrible idea. You have to have an idea first. It's, I want to do something in the world.
Yeah.
I have this idea in my head, and it's burning inside of me so much that I feel physical pain if I don't manifest it. Okay, then start the company. So when people say, I want to become a serial entrepreneur, that to me is complete gibberish. It's like,
gibberish.
Tell me the differentiated insight that you have, whether I agree with it or not, that is going to motivate you to drive and do this. And if you're 18 years old or you're 45 or 90 years old, it doesn't matter. That's the reason you should start it. So there's people that disagree with me on this, but I think that this idea of deciding that your occupation is going to be an entrepreneur is a weird thing to do. Right? It's I want to do something.
Absolutely.
In the world. And then you have to think in a very objective and unemotional way, what is the best way for me to implement this? Is it a business? Is it a nonprofit? Is it a bill that I have to pass? Should I become a public speaker and actually just evangelize this idea and share? Should I write books? Like, you have to then think about what form does it take? Then you have to think about the business plan and how you're going to manifest it. So I think there's a lot of people that glamorize the very small number of people that have succeeded in business and then say, I'm going to do that too, but they don't have the idea. Then there's a lot of people that have amazing ideas, but then they don't believe in themselves enough to start
exactly.
And that's a whole other problem. So
I mean,
so that's
you need to have all the combination. I always say, if you have a vision, you need to have a conviction.
Yes.
Even if you have conviction, you don't have determination, you fail. You have to have the three elements together.
Yes, and luck.
And luck is definite, but there's a lot of people who doesn't have vision as well.
Yeah,
that's true. Luck is essential.
By the way, this goes back to the media thing. One of the things that allows you to develop vision, some people just have it, but it is books and it's long form content. If you just subsist off of TikToks, If you just think in 6-second intervals, how are you going to come up with a coherent vision of the future when the content you're consuming is the definition of the present? It's the definition of short.
Absolutely.
So when you go and you read biographies of these great leaders, and you've read 100 of them, you can see how vision starts and how it manifests. And this is, again, I'm like a shill for the book industry, I guess. Like, I'm upset. Is like, I will pitch books the rest of my life because it's the greatest tool I've ever encountered. Is you can cheat. You can cheat in life. And the way you can cheat is that you can live 1,000 lives by reading 1,000 biographies. You can inherit ideas that took thousands of years to come up with.
Yes.
How hard was it for Pythagoras to figure out the Pythagorean theorem? And now we teach it to people in second, third grade, I guess. Right? And so things that were so challenging to the activation energy was so infinitesimally high, right? Or so infinitely high, we can now just read and then we can build on top of that. And so one of the things I've talked with Nicholas Berggruen about, for example, is the concept of are there ever original ideas? And maybe there are, maybe there aren't, but the vast majority of ideas are not original.
No.
They're just stacking together other ideas like Legos, like building blocks. So my only point is, how could you have a vision if you don't have the blocks to build it on?
Business is about ideas, but many profession I always consider is luck and luck.
Of course. Of course.
Luck. And also opportunities.
Yes.
Whether you grab opportunities. Data is in order to succeed. Actually, data is help. The more you know, the better.
But it's hard. So
it's
here's,
hard.
So here's
very
the,
hard.
But here's the thing.
And
here's
also, you have to have balls to carry through.
You have to have balls. Here's why you have to have the balls, right? When you accumulate a lot of knowledge from other people, you do realize extraordinarily valuable things about how the world works, about how ideas actually end up manifesting, about experience. Mm-hmm. You don't actually have the experience of doing it, but there is value in going through that. You also learn all of the reasons why your idea won't work.
Of course, of course.
So it's there is value, again, going back to starting my organization at a young age, was when I was so not well-read,
yes.
And I had not actually put that, you're delusional enough to not know. So
you don't recognize the obstacle.
It's exceptionally hard. And I think that's why the people that I've met that are more risk on as they get older, that they want to take more risks, they're more delusional as they get older, but can continue to succeed. Those are the extraordinarily special people. Because there's a lot of people that are...
Agree.
Yeah, it's very challenging to do that.
I absolutely agree. Thank you so much, Henry.
Thank you for having me. This is wonderful.
Oh, such a wonderful talk. You know, you're brilliant.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.